upon some future day. But take your hats off to plucky, lucky Lindbergh, the eagle of the USA. Through the day and the night, on his famous flight, Lind is just right to his post. As he flew from coast to coast, making good his early boast. In the far off west, one he loved the best, said a prayer to God above, and she guided him and helped him with a mother's wondrous love. For Lindbergh, oh, what a flying fool was he. Lindbergh, his name will live in history. Over the ocean he flew all alone, gambling with fate and with dangers unknown. Others may make that trip across the sea upon some future day, but take your hats off to plucky, lucky Lindbergh, the eagle of the USA. Across the sea upon some future day, but take your hats off to plucky, lucky Lindbergh, the eagle of the USA.
Recorded in 1927, that was Lindbergh, the Eagle of the USA, and it was sung for us by Vernon Dalhart. It's 4 minutes after three. This is Fresh Air on WUHY FM in Philadelphia, and I just want to take out a moment to say thank you again to everybody who supported us during our spring marathon fundraiser, which concluded yesterday, and we did finally go over the goal. We were concerned about whether we'd make it, and on the last day, you helped put us over the goal, so I want to thank everybody who's contributed to WUHY. Thanks a lot. Well, with me now on Fresh Air is Ronnie Blakely, the actress, singer, and pianist who became well-known through her film debut in Nashville, directed by Robert Altman. Blakely played the role of Barbara Jean, the country music star who's assassinated at the end of the film while performing at a political rally for a presidential candidate, popular amongst many country musicians. She's shot by a soldier who's recently arrived in Nashville with his guitar case, which you learn was actually not carrying a guitar, but rather a gun. Many people found themselves thinking of this scene when John Lennon was shot. This was the first time that a music star was assassinated, in this movie. It seemed to foreshadow the real thing in some ways. Although she's associated with country music from her role in Nashville, she's also a pianist trained at Juilliard, and she describes her music now as new wave country. Blakely was part of the Rolling Thunder review, which toured around with Bob Dylan, and she worked with Dylan again in his film Rinaldo and Clara. Her other film appearances include The Driver, in which she played opposite Ryan O'Neill, and a made-for-TV version of The Glass Menagerie, and Lightning Over Water, which was directed by Wim Wenders. Also in this film was the late Nicholas Ray, the director of the classic films Johnny Guitar and Rebel Without a Cause. Ronnie Blakely will be performing tonight at the Bijou, and that's at 8 o'clock, and the Bijou's on Broad and Lombard Streets. Ronnie Blakely, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks a lot.
I'm sure a lot of our listeners know you from your appearance in Nashville, so I thought maybe we could start there. You wrote a lot of that role yourself. The most famous scene, I think, in that movie that you wrote was the scene where you're performing on stage and you just start spacing out and telling stories from your childhood and obviously undergoing the beginnings of some kind of nervous breakdown. How did that scene evolve for you?
Well, it evolved the night before we shot it because it didn't exist in the script. She was supposed to go to a shopping center and sing and then collapse again in a faint. And they changed it to Opryland instead of the shopping center. And it just seemed to me like if she just fainted again, that wouldn't really be taking it anyplace. And it seemed to me that it would be good to put more of a musical phrase to it. And that it was good. It would be good if the audience could see her strength as well as her frailty. In other words, how hard she was struggling to be on stage and how much it did mean to her. And the fine line between the reality and unreality, or the fine line between sanity and insanity. So that she wasn't such a one-dimensional figure.
Had you ever seen that happen to someone on stage?
Uh-uh.
I did.
You did?
Yeah, to Big Mama Thornton once.
Honestly?
She stopped playing and just started, not quite in this way, but just started to go into this really strange rap about her past. And the audience got really nervous because she didn't know what to do, whether you should stay and listen or walk out of respect. It was a very, very difficult thing. What kind of, you got a lot of good feedback, I'm sure, to that scene.
Well, yeah, Bob liked it. I remember the next day in makeup, I was really nervous, and I asked him to come down, and he came down and wanted to know what I wanted. And then I showed it to him, my journal, and read it to him. He said, "Do you know it?" And I said, "Yes." So he said, "Okay, we'll shoot it." Then it was his idea to break it up, because I'd written it as a monologue. It was his idea to break it up like three times, like to have her try to start singing again and have the band start playing and then have her start talking again. So that was his idea, and then we just shot it. So he liked it, and everybody liked it, and that's the way I thought that movies were done.
Yeah, what are some of the advantages and disadvantages working with a director as flexible as Altman and someone who relies on improvisation as much as he does?
Well, it's great to work with someone like that. For one thing, you're dealing with somebody who trusts himself as well as he trusts and invites the contributions of his fellow workers. And that's something that, you know, just can't be overvalued. I mean, it's just the best feeling in the world. And the worst feeling in the world is when nobody trusts anybody's judgment, nobody wants anybody to have any ideas. And that's the opposite, which I consider that's a difficult working condition.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the possible problems, and I think, like for me, Altman's had his great successes and his failures, but I guess sometimes when you're relying a lot on improvisation, there's the danger that the film won't have a center to it.
Right.
But that didn't seem to happen in Nashville.
No, Nashville had a very good script.
When Lennon was killed, a lot of people thought about the film Nashville. As a matter of fact, Susan Stamberg on All Things Considered, the night of the murder, interviewed Robert Altman about what he was thinking about when making the movie, since it did seem to foreshadow the heroic proportions that musicians and artists have gotten to in the country. Did you think about that scene in Nashville?
I don't know if I did at the time it happened exactly, but I know I tore out a piece of the New York Times the next day that had him on the cover signing the record, and then it had in the article it said it somehow was reminiscent of the assassination in Nashville and of the killing of Al Lowenstein last year. And all these things tied together somehow. I put it on my bulletin board in my editing room. I was editing a videotape at the time, really night and day. So I couldn't even listen to anything or watch any TV. When I heard about it, I didn't think about my part at all. But it did make me feel pretty violent, pretty angry myself. I was sitting in a restaurant with some friends, and somebody said, "Hey, did you hear John Lennon got shot?" And I said, "You know, you're joking." I said, "No." And then we went, so then no one felt like eating, and so we went next door where there was somebody playing some music, and we were crammed into this place. And I know the guy I was sitting next to, his glass knocked over on the floor, and a piece of glass went onto my leg and made it bleed, and I was kind of glad, you know? Like, I was just so mad. I really, really felt angry. I felt so mad when Kent State happened, and I just felt so mad and so hideously helpless.
Helpless, right.
You know.
Did anyone bring up that scene with you?
No. Well, since then now some people have, but nobody did at the time. But I don't think I was seeing anybody at the time. I was just working. That one night I just was out for some dinner or whatever.
When Nashville was over and you started recording again, did people see you as carrying on the role of the country singer who you played in Nashville and of, you know, wanting you to play the same tunes that you did as her in the movie?
Mm-hmm. I finally adjusted to that, but at first it was very difficult for me, and I rebelled against it tremendously. I felt really rebellious that I was expected to be her. You know?
Expected by who? Your audience is? Record company?
Everybody.
Everybody?
Sure. Except the people who already did know me.
What had you been doing before that musically?
I had cut a record in 72, which was responsible for me getting the part in Nashville. I had started out in summer stock, and I had attended Stanford, graduated Stanford, gone to school in Europe, gone to Juilliard, all of which was really a good education, which I immediately kept to myself because I thought that invalidated me as a rock musician. So I never really told anybody that when I came to Los Angeles to join a rock and roll band from New York where I'd been playing electronic music with synthesizers and stuff. In fact, the first time synthesizers were in Carnegie Hall, I was improvising with ring modulators and stuff. But anyway, so I went west to join a band, and then I'd already started writing, and I didn't care for acting because I somehow didn't think it was very dignified to be taking one's photographs around. And so then I was playing in little clubs for not very much money. And then some of my friends liked my work, so I got a job as scoring a movie for Fox, which was about four Green Berets returning from the DMZ, and they were disenfranchised and ended up slaughtering a town of 85 people in Hope, New Mexico. Well, that was before we'd invaded Cambodia, so that film was shelved. But that was really neat. And from that, I got my first record deal. Then I went on tour. So I toured a lot, and then I started working with other artists as backup and on tour, like with Hoyt Axton and Pure Prairie League and stuff like that. And then that's when Altman was putting together Nashville, and a friend of mine, Richard Baskin, who was the music director for that movie, wanted to use some of the songs from my first record for the people to sing in the movie. So therefore I met Bob, and then I was out on the road, and then they asked me to do the movie. So I did the movie, and the songs had been on my first record, so it's not like it was phony, but it was, I felt much closer, and still do, to somebody like Linda Ronstadt, or whatever, you know, a kid, Linda's dad, you know, runs a hardware store in Tucson or something, you know, my dad's a civil engineer in Caldwell, Idaho, and it's just a different milieu to come out of. So to be thought that you come out of one thing when you come out of another is frustrating, because what happens is people get, they are either disappointed or they feel betrayed because they think you lied to them.
I know what you mean.
You know, especially with Nashville, where people thought, you know, Barbara Jean, they either liked her or didn't like her, but when they saw that I wasn't her, I think it disappointed some people.
We'll talk a little later about other films that you've been doing, but let's talk a little bit about the music you're doing now. We'll be hearing a selection of yours in a couple of minutes, but how would you describe what you're doing or what we'd hear if we go to hear you at the Bijou tonight?
Well, tonight you'll hear me solo. I've been playing off and on with bands for the past 2 years. I went through a period where I wouldn't even play any country music. I wouldn't play the songs from Nashville. I think that was just a backlash. Now I do Bluebird, Dues, Idaho Home, and Tape Deck, all four of them in my show. In fact, I do almost a retrospective because my first album was really eclectic as it was. So that I'll do a Bluebird, and then I'll do a Fred Hampton, then I'll do an older country-flavored love song. And the thing about rock and roll is you really can't play it by yourself anyway. So tunes that take on a more rock or a more new wave aspect when you've either orchestrated them or run them through a band or at least arranged them. When you play them solo, they still do blend in all together. And, you know, I'll never forsake the country music that I love. But the fact is that it was an acquired thing for me at about the age of, say, 16 and 17 when I first began listening to Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and a little bit of Johnny Cash. And then started delving back into the roots of where they came from, that I got into country music. I didn't get into country music from my own parents, for example.
We're going to be hearing your performance of one of your own tunes, Mama Lied. Would you like to say anything about this before we hear it?
Well, Patricia Resnick wrote the words to this one. We worked on it together. She wrote 9 to 5. And when I played this one for my mom, she immediately wanted to know. I said, "No, Mom, I didn't write the words on this one." But that's all about it. It's kind of a country rock song, and it was done with a band in L.A. It's a demo. It hasn't been put on record yet.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Ronnie Blakely, who's, by the way, in Philadelphia to perform this evening at the Bijou.
Great. Thanks.
See it, but you give everything you want to.
Mama Lyde, the music was written by Ronnie Blakely. And she'll be at the Bijou this evening, performing solo, by the way, and she plays both guitar and piano. You said before, Ronnie, that when you were about 16 or so, you started listening to Bob Dylan, and then when you got a little older, you ended up touring with him as part of Rolling Thunder, and then you performed in his movie. What was the difference between listening to, like, you know, Bob Dylan, mythical cultural hero, on the record player, and meeting him and working with him?
Well, the difference was, you know, just in the flesh. I mean, he was great. He didn't diminish his talent, you know. I was still in awe of him and still am in awe of him. I think he's, you know, just one of the greatest talent, a giant of a talent.
A lot of people are mystified by his religiousness that has now changed his life and also changed his songs.
Mm-hmm.
Are you surprised or baffled?
Well, I was surprised, yes, I was. But and I haven't talked to him much either for about the past year and a half or so. So I only know from our mutual friends and stuff. And a lot of our mutual friends have been born again.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Like Stephen Souls, T-Bone Burnett, Davey Mansfield. I can't remember now whether it's good manners to talk about that. Maybe I shouldn't say anything about that.
How do you feel about it, though?
Well, I personally am not. I was brought up Christian, but I would say that I'm agnostic and not a very religious person.
Mm-hmm.
I have respect for spirituality, certainly, and the sensitivity and the motion of the universe.
I never got to see the Dylan movie that you were in, Ronaldo and Clara, but it didn't stay open for very long.
No, I think it's a work of genius, but it sure was panned by a lot of critics.
Do you think that that's why it wasn't around for very long, because
sure,
of the critical reviews it got?
Sure, it was not an easy movie. It was not your easy commercial movie, no. It was long, it was unusual, it was more like a poem.
Mm-hmm.
It was really much, it was a very poetic kind of a movie. It wasn't easy, but I just loved it. I thought it was beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Of the movies that you've done to date, which are the one or the ones that you feel best about?
I feel the best about Nashville and Ronaldo and Clara and Lightning Over Water and...
Well, Lightning Over Water...
I think those are the best, really.
Lightning Over Water also had
Nicholas Ray co-directed it with Wim Wenders, and it was done at the time of Nick's death and his severe illness, so it was a semi-documentary. Just a very moving and very beautiful movie. It's just won the prize of the year in Germany. I did the score for that, too, and, you know, it was an incredible honor to work with Nick and get to know him, even in the time of his, especially perhaps at the time of his extreme illness.
Do you know what was responsible for him dropping out of film?
He was a rebel. He was a rebel in his own words. Let's see, how did he express it so succinctly? In Hollywood, if you say no a couple of times, you're difficult. And if you're difficult, who needs you? It's a pretty good way to put it.
Yeah. Did you think he was bitter about it?
I think that one reason he even did this movie was, in his own words again, was to regain his esteem and his self-esteem and his position of respect in the eyes of the world. I think he, you know, felt that he had been given short shrift. But then he was the first one to say that he was a wild man, too. He made a movie which showed this in great detail, You Can't Go Home. Again, and even in there, I mean, like Kenneth Anger's split screen stuff and shooting, like running film on a drive-in movie and then shooting the film on the drive-in movie with this twilight sky in the background and all kinds of artsy stuff and like getting, I mean, here I'm not saying that it's artsy to get busted for drugs, but I mean, he revealed and exposed himself and his students in a brilliant way. I think he never stopped working at all. And he certainly did do great work. I used some of the stuff of his own words, like on Rebel Without a Cause, he wrote, a darkened planetarium, the universe shifts, they fight without cause, they walk away. Well, I used that, for example, to lay down, I chose metronome settings, certain length of time, what kind of a beat, what kind of a pulse I wanted, mapped it out, then composed a drum part to match each of those feels, like with brushes, sticks, or whatever, laid down the drums, then would lay down, then laid down string, bass, and violin together on top of that, then laid down lead guitar on top of that, then laid down Ian Underwood and I, who plays for Zappa, he and I laid down synthesizer on top of that. And that's how I constructed the music for the movie in suites. Like one was called Rebel Without a Cause, one was called Johnny Guitar, one was called In a Lonely Place, and one was called The Lusty Men. And then the title song, Lightning Over Water, that was Nick's own title. And everybody worked, you know, very closely.
That hasn't come to America yet, has it?
No.
Will it? Do you know what the future
is? Yeah, it will. But it takes a while sometimes with these films, you know, when there is, I mean, I hate to put the name art film on it, not because I'm not ashamed of art, but sometimes it turns people away.
Mm-hmm. Having worked in both the film industry and the record industry, is it easier to maneuver around either?
Good question. Well, if you're a musician, for me, it all originates with writing. Because then you're your own source. So for me, most of my movie work and stuff has come out of the fact somewhere, if you trace it back to the, you know, prime move, it's that because I was a writer. So because I was a writer and I wrote songs which got recorded onto a record, then I got to be in this movie Nashville. And because I was in that movie Nashville, then I was in other movies. Or because I was good in Nashville, then Bob Dylan met me and then listened to me play and liked my song, so then I did work with Bob Dylan. Or because Wim Wenders saw this work, or because Walter Hill saw this work. So whatever it comes down to is, if people then see other work of yours, or of mine, since it's me we're talking about, I think it's probably due to the fact that I am a bit of a writer. Acting, as you know, of course, is difficult to do by yourself. You know,
right.
Unless you want to be like a magician and sit in your room in front of a mirror for 7 hours a day.
How do you decide what role you're going to take, or which role you're going to even go after?
Good question again. Right now, for example, I was just asked to make a phone call outside because I heard about something that I want to do. I was just dialing 9-4 or whatever.
I'm trying to get out there. Outside line.
Yeah,
that's
trying
right.
to get. I want to call up Los Angeles because I heard about a project that's going on that I want to do. I want to play George O'Keefe, and they're going to do it with music and stuff. So I want to call up and say, I'm interested in this part. I'd like to do it. I'm going to call up the producers.
You said before that before you had really gotten into film, you didn't want to get into acting because it was kind of humiliating to have to travel around with your picture all over.
Yeah, I don't think it is humiliating for the people who do it. Don't get me wrong, I'm not putting them down. I personally just wear my heart too much on my sleeve a little bit, or maybe I'm too insecure. But it is a hard thing, I think.
So once you've been in movies and people can see your work or have already seen your work, is it different trying to get a role? I mean, you don't have to go around to different agencies with your photograph anymore.
Well, in some ways one needs to, although one doesn't. But it's odd, too, because I'll tell you what they do say, which is just a funny catch-22. They'll say, we don't need to see a picture of her because we know what she looks like from Nashville.
Right, so it's being typed again in a way, right?
Which is not what I really look like on my own. But that's not to complain. You know, those are jobs that are up to it. That's why people have agents.
Right.
You know, so you send, you know, your films around or your TV. I've certainly done enough work by now that I can send around my work. But, and I do enjoy it, and I do enjoy TV a lot, too, because it moves fast.
Yeah,
so you can go in and shoot an hour program in a week, and plus, you know, it's going to be on TV in a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
You can spend 3 months doing an hour movie, and it may never even get distributed. No one may ever see it. So you can start out, you know, with a little attitude of snobbery, but I don't think it's a very, very good attitude to hang on to. It doesn't mean anything.
Are made-for-television movies different to act in than movies for theatrical release?
Usually only in the fact that they shoot a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the crews are, if anything, just as good. You know, the cameras are the same. The film stock is the same. So it's usually your shooting schedule or whatever that's different.
Do you have things coming up that we can look for on TV in the near future?
On TV, I don't think so. Baltimore Bullet, I think, has been, I don't know if that's been on the East Coast yet with James Coburn and Omar Sharif. That was just on cable in L.A. I'm getting ready to do a movie with Roger Vadim called Acapella, about a songwriter who leaves her husband and takes a child and then, you know, is intent on having a career, and she has a career, and then she gets her husband back. So we're getting ready to do that one. And Lightning Over Water should be coming out, but I don't expect that to be on TV soon.
Right. Well, I'll look forward to seeing that. I hope that comes to our area. I want to thank you, Ronnie Blakely, very much for coming to Fresh Air this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
I wish you,
thank you for having me.
Wish you good luck with your film and music careers, and I look forward to seeing you in more movies.
Thanks a lot, dear. I hope everybody will come out tonight to the Bijou.
And that's this evening at, I guess, sets at 8 and 10:30. The Bijou's at Broad and Lombard Streets. And again, Ronnie Blakely will be performing by herself. Now, she plays piano and guitar, so she, of course, also sings. So that will be tonight at the Bijou at 8 and 10:30. And just to recap, she has a couple of records and was also did a very memorable appearance in the film Nashville, and we were just talking about some of her more recent film appearances. It's 3:31, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Every Tuesday at this time, we feature Jazz Revisited with host Hazen Schumacher, and the subject on Jazz Revisited today is jazz compositions whose titles bear the names of a jazz performer.
Saxophone demonstration number called Trombology, featuring Frankie Trumbauer. Sitting in with him are Bix Beiderbecke and Eddie Lang. We're going to play that and a few others on today's program, Namesakes.
Jazz Revisited. Revisited, a review of the first three decades of recorded American jazz, 1917 to 1947, the artists and their music, a program produced at the University of Michigan. Here is your host, Hazen Schumacher.
It's interesting as you delve into the titles of compositions which jazz musicians or big band composers come up with, because they reflect the whole, well, just a lot of them are frivolous. A lot of them have names of people in them. A lot of them are thought of at the last moment. Very few of them, I think it's fair to say very few of them have much of a relationship to the actual content of the music. For example, the first two we're going to play are both tributes to Benny Moten, who led that pioneer Kansas City band in the 20s. And the first one is Moten Swing, which was